This is the NBC University Theater, bringing you the seventh in our series of dramatizations of outstanding works by modern British and American authors. Today, Van Heflin stars in the title role of the Sinclair Lewis novel, Aerosmith.
Driver of the wagon swaying through the Ohio wilderness was a ragged girl of 14.
Come on now!
She had buried her mother near a river some miles back, and on the floor of the wagon lay her father, shrinking with fever. As she halted at a fork in the road, the sick man quavered.
Emmy!
Huh?
You better turn down towards Cincinnati. If we could find your Uncle Ed, I guess he'd take us in.
Nobody ain't going to take us in. We're going on. Going west. Giddy up!
That was the great-grandmother of Martin Arrowsmith. By 1906, Winnemac was a thriving Midwestern state, much like its neighbors, Michigan, Ohio, Illinois, and Indiana. It boasted the bustling city of Zenith and, 15 miles away in the town of Mohalis, a brisk state university with 5,000 students. But even as late as 1906, Martin Arrowsmith, beginning his first year at the medical school of the university, still had a strain of the pioneer explorer, and along with the desire and impatience to be at it. It was a portentous hour as he hurried into the slate-colored hall of the main medical. He was going to specialize in bacteriology. The great Professor Gottlieb was going to recognize him as a genius. But then he stood before the door of the professor's cubbyhole of an office.
Bill? Yes?
Professor Gottlieb, my name is Arrowsmith. I'm a medic freshman, Winnemac B.A., and, look, I'd sure like to take bacteriology this fall instead of next year. You see, I've had a lot of chemistry.
No, it is not time for you.
Well, honestly, I know I could do it now if you just...
There are two kinds of students that the gods give me. One kind they dump on me like a bushel of potatoes. I take them and teach them to kill patients. The other kind, there are very few. They seem to wish a little bit to become scientists. I teach them right away the ultimate lesson of science, which is to... wait and doubt.
But honestly, you see, with my chemistry...
Have you taken physical chemistry?
No, sir, not physical, but I did very well in organic.
Organic
and
chemistry, puzzle chemistry, stink chemistry, drugstore chemistry. That is a trade for pot washers. No, you are too young. Come back in a year.
At the college inn, while devouring an enormous banana split and a bar of almond chocolate, Martin meditated.
I want to take bacteriology. I want to take bacteriology now. Well, I'll show old Gottlieb. Someday I'll discover the germ of cancer or something, and then I'll make him look foolish. Oh, Lord, I hope I won't get sick the first time I go into the dissecting room.
By his sophomore year, Martin had grudgingly to admit that Gottlieb had been right about physical chemistry. And the confusion of the bacteriological laboratory was ecstasy to him. The most radiant things in the world were rows of test tubes filled with watery serum and plugged with cotton, singed to a coffee brown. He had begun, perhaps in youthful imitation of Gottlieb, to work by himself in the laboratory at night.
You're so late, Martin.
Oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir. I'm studying trypanosomes from a rat.
Let me have a look at your slide.
Yes, sir.
You have stained the germs very well. Yes, splendid. You have craftsmanship.
Do you really think so, Professor?
Not five times in 5 years do I have students who understand craftsmanship and precision. and maybe some big imagination and hypothesis. I think perhaps you may have them.
Oh, I certainly hope so, Professor.
Don't misunderstand. I do not think you will be a good doctor. Good doctors are fine. Often they are artists. But their trade is not for us lonely ones that work in labs. I will have a little sandwich in my room at midnight. If you should happen to work so late, I should be very pleased if you would come have a bite.
After the midnight supper and a rambling talk, Martin ran home altogether drunk with happiness. The rest of that year, three things occupied Martin Arrowsmith's mind. Bacteriology, Professor Gottlieb, and to a somewhat lesser degree, Madeline Fox. Madeline was a handsome, high-spirited, opinionated girl whom Martin had known in college. She was staying on ostensibly to take a graduate course in English, actually to avoid going home. Martin thought her particularly desirable and attractive. But it's doubtful he would ever have proposed to her except for that spring evening on the roof of her apartment house.
Hi, Madeline.
Hello.
Your mother said you were up here. I say, those Japanese lanterns you hung up lately look keen. That's a dandy new strip of matting you put down here.
Oh, it is not. It's mangy, and you know it.
Hey, what's the matter, Madeline?
Oh, Mart, I'm so sick of myself tonight. I'm always trying to make people think I'm somebody. I'm not a... I'm just a bluff.
Oh, now, wait a minute. Come on, now, what is it, dear?
Oh, lots.
Come on, tell me.
Well, Dr. Brumford, hang him. I'm not doing a thing, he said. And if I don't have my Ph.D., I won't be able to land a nice job teaching English in some swell school. I'd better land one, too. Because it doesn't look to poor Madeline as if anybody was going to marry her.
Well, now, wait a minute. I know exactly who...
I tell people how clever I am. I don't suppose they believe it. Probably they go off and laugh at
me. No, they do not. If they did, well, I'd just like to see anybody try laughing at you
it's
once.
It's awfully sweet and dear of you. But I'm not worth it. I'll have to go home with Mother. I can't stand it, Mark. I just can't stand it. I won't go back. I won't.
No. Look, darling, look. Come on, put your head on my shoulder.
Oh, Mark.
Look, you know, I almost feel as if I dared to love you. You know what? I tell you, you're going to marry me. Well, it'll take a couple of more years, of course, but then we're going to get married. By thunder, with you helping me, I'm going to climb right to the top and we'll be a big surgeon. We're going to have everything.
Oh, well, dearest, do be wise. I don't want to keep you from your scientific work.
Oh, well, I would like to keep up some research, but I'm not just a lab cat. There's no reason I can't do both.
Oh, Martin.
Madeline.
Mart, dear, now that we're engaged, Mother will want us to go to church with her. We could just once, don't you think? And, darling, the very first free time you have, let's go into Zenith and buy you a new pair of trousers. Those corduroy ones are really quite shabby.
For a year, Madeline waged various crusades to improve Martin at the same time, managing to make him feel grateful and lucky. And then Gottlieb sent him into the huge Zenith General Hospital to secure a strain of meningococcus from an interesting patient. Martin wandered through the long corridors trying to look important, hoping to be taken for a doctor, and succeeded only in feeling extraordinarily embarrassed.
Nurse, I want to find Ward D.
Do you?
Yes, I do. If I can interrupt your work long enough
matter.
To...
Oh, it doesn't matter. The darn superintendent of nurses put me at scrubbing, and we aren't even supposed to scrub floors. She caught me smoking a cigarette. She's an old terror. she found a child like you wandering around here, she'd drag you out by the ear.
My dear young woman, it may interest you to know that
my
I am...
My dear young woman. Sounds exactly like our old prof.
I am Dr. Arrowsmith. And I've been informed that even probationers learn that the first duty of a nurse is to stand when addressing doctors. I wish to find Ward D to take a strain. It may interest you to know of a very dangerous microbe. So if you'll kindly direct me to Ward...
Oh, gee, I've been getting fresh again. I don't seem to get along with this military discipline. All right, I'll stand up. You... you go back, turn right, and then left. Hmm. Oh, I'm sorry, I was fresh. But if you saw some of the old muffs of doctors that a nurse has to be meek to, why, honestly, doctor... That is, if you really are a doctor. Oh, you're back.
Yes, I came to, well, I was going to bawl you out for your impudence, but now I've forgotten what I meant to say.
I didn't mean to be rude. I was just... Oh, well, scrubbing makes me bad-tempered. I thought you were awfully nice, and I'm sorry I hurt your feelings, but you did seem so young for a doctor.
Well, I'm not. I'm a medic. I was just showing off.
So was I.
It's pretty hard, this training for a nurse, I guess, isn't it?
Oh, it's not so awful. But it's just as romantic as being a hired girl. That's what we call them in Dakota.
Oh, you come from Dakota?
Mm-hmm. From the most enterprising town in the entire state of North Dakota, Wheatsylvania. 362 inhabitants, unless the Nordblums have had their seventh child already, and that would make it 63.
Hey, what do they call you?
Me? Oh, well, it's an idiotic name. Leora Tozer.
What's the matter with Leora? I think that's fine. Look, when can you get away from the hospital for dinner? Tonight, maybe?
Oh, why?
Come on, please, huh?
All right.
When can I call for you?
Well, I really shouldn't, you know. Well, 7 o'clock. If we don't stop having dinner together so often, I'm going to get fired and you'll flunk out of medical school.
Yeah, I don't care. I guess I bore you, though. I talk too much.
Oh, no. I like having you trust me. I'm not, well, earnest, and I haven't any brains whatever, but I do love it when my men folks think I'm intelligent enough to hear what they really think.
Oh, no, you have brains. You have lots of
brains.
Oh,
no, I don't, but I don't care. I want to call you Sandy.
What?
Mm-hmm. Why do I? Well, you're as unsandy as can be, but... Somehow you're Sandy to me.
Well, no, I like that.
I suppose I bore you, though, telling you all about my folks and Wheatsylvania and all.
Look, you'll never bore me. But you don't have to tell me about you. I've always known you, darling. And I'm not going to let you go no matter what. You're going to marry me.
Martin went home, engaged to two girls at once.
Oh, Mark, darling. Oh, I'm so glad you called. I've missed you so. Of course, I know how busy you are and that I have to play second fiddle to all those
Listen,
little bugs.
Listen, Madeline, there's a great friend of mine in Zenith that I want you to meet.
Oh?
You'll see tomorrow. I want you to come in and have lunch with, I tell you what, we'll all have lunch. I want you to meet me at the 1140 Interurban at College Square. Now, can you do that?
Oh, Mart, I'd love to, but I have an 11 o'clock and I don't like to cut it. And I promised May Harmon to go shopping with her. We sort of thought maybe we might lunch at Ye College Care.
Now, listen, this is important. Will you come or not?
Dear,
I'll come.
Mr. Arrowsmith tells me you're a nurse, Miss, Tozier.
Yes, sort of.
Madeline, the reason...
Do you find it interesting?
Yes.
To...
Yes, I think it's interesting. I suppose it must be wonderful to relieve suffering. Of course, my work... I'm taking my doctorate philosophy degree in English. It's rather dry and detached.
Well, yes, it must... No, it must be very interesting.
Look, Madeline,
do you come from Zenith, Miss Tozer?
No. No, I come from, well, just a little town. Well, hardly a town. North Dakota.
Oh? North Dakota?
Mm-hmm. Way west.
Oh, yes.
Are
you
staying
east for some time?
Oh, well, I'd... Yes. Yes, I guess I may be here quite some time.
Do you, do you find you like it here?
Oh, yes, it's pretty nice. These big cities, there's so much to see.
Big? Oh, well, I suppose it all depends on the point of view.
Look, I don't...
Doesn't it?
Like
to... tell me, Martin, dear, are you planning some more work on the, what is it, with rabbits?
Look, Madeline, I brought you two together because... Now, I don't know whether you'll cotton to each other or not, but I wish you could because I've, Well, now look, I'm not making any excuses for myself. I just couldn't help it. I'm engaged to both of you, and...
You're engaged... Well...
Madeline, I don't...
Don't get upset, Martin. I won't make a scene. Miss Tozer, dear, I'm sorry for you. You've got a job on your hands. You poor baby. Goodbye.
Sandy.
Yeah?
Sandy, I might as well tell you now. I'm never going to give you up. You're mine.
Leora.
Oh, no, wait a minute. Don't think so well of yourself. I guess you are pretty selfish. Perhaps you like me because I tag after you and she never would. Oh, I simply adore you frightfully. Well, heaven knows why. Well, she has sense enough to make you admire her and tag after her, but... You're mine.
Look, darling, don't think that she's any brighter than you are. She's just glib, but she's not, Oh, come on, let's stop talking. I've found you, and my life's begun.
They were married the next year. With the responsibility of a wife, Martin decided he should become a general practitioner and thereby assure himself of an immediate livelihood. But always stirring within him was the desire for scientific research, a gnawing desire that made him restless and finally unpopular. And so through years marked by dull routine or battling enmities, he and Leora moved from Wheatsylvania to Nautilus, from Nautilus to Chicago. And then came the letter from Max Gottlieb, now at the McGurk Institute of Biology in New York.
Dear Martin, I have read with great pleasure your paper recently printed in the Journal of Infectious Diseases. I have spoken about you to Dr. Tobes, head of the Institute. When are you coming to us? To me. Your laboratory is waiting for you.
Oh, Sandy. I know I'm simply going to adore New York.
Born to the prairies, never far from the site of the cornfields, Martin was conveyed to blazing lands and great enterprises. To the McGurk building, a sheer wall, 30 blank stories of glass and limestone, down in the pinched triangle where New York rules a quarter of the world.
So, this is your laboratory, Martin.
This is just about... Well, it's all I ever dreamed. Look, Dr. Gottlieb, do you really think that I know enough to work here?
If you will look mysterious all the time, Dr. Tobes, our director, will think you are up to something big. Perhaps I am a crank, Martin. But remember that all men who work at science are not scientists. You will see that even here, I regret to say. To be a scientist, well, it is born in you.
Martin had closed the door of his laboratory and let his spirit flow out and fill that minute apartment with his own essence, he felt secure, and he prayed the prayer of the scientist.
God give me unclouded eyes and freedom from haste. God give me a quiet and relentless anger against all pretense and all pretentious work, and all work left slack and unfinished. God give me a restlessness whereby I may not sleep nor accept praise until my observed results equal my calculated results. Or in pious glee, I discover and assault my error. God give me strength not to trust to God.
Martin soon understood Max Gottlieb's statement that all men of science are not scientists. During the next 3 years, he was often annoyed by the money mad, the social climbers, and those who gave in to petty jealousies. Then his research wiped out everything else, as he realized that he had something at the mysterious source of life.
You sent for me, Dr. Gottlieb?
Yes, Martin. Sit down.
Thank you.
Martin, perhaps you have thought I have neglected you lately.
Oh, no, sir,
It is true that since I have been made director of the Institute, I do not have time for all the things I should like. Oh, even my own research must suffer. But I have closely studied your work with your phage principle.
Well, one can't really know its value, though, until it's had a thorough test.
Exactly. How would you like the opportunity to conduct such a test?
Well, sir, that would be the dream of
yes,
any...
Yes, it comes to me that there is bubonic plague in the West Indies. They have heard of your work in phage and appeal to us for help.
Well,
could trust you, Martin, to use the phage with only half your patients and keep the others as controls without the phage, then you could make an absolute determination of its value. If I could trust you to do that, I would send you down to San Hubert. What do you think?
Give me the chance, Dr. Gottlieb. I swear to you that I'll observe test conditions.
If you go, you must promise me, Martin. Promise not to let anything, not even your own good, kind heart, spoil your experiment at San Hubert. You must refuse to let yourself indulge in pity for the men you will see dying. You will go on these conditions, Martin?
On those conditions, sir. Yes, I will go.
I'm going with you.
You are not.
Well, I am.
It's not safe,
Silly.
Leora.
Of course it is. You can shoot me full of your nice old phage, and then I'll be absolutely all
listen,
right.
Listen, Lee. Darling, listen. I do think that the phage will immunize against the plague, but I don't know. Now, you simply can't go, Leora. You've got
Sandy,
to...
Sandy, don't you know that I haven't any life outside of you? I might have had, but honestly, I've been glad to let you absorb me. If you were off there and I didn't know that you were all right, or if you died and somebody else cared for you, I'd go mad.
Darling, don't make it any harder for me. It's going to be hard enough. In any case,
Sandy,
you
Arrowsmith,
can't...
don't you dare use those old stuck-up expressions that husbands have been drooling out to wives forever and ever. Oh, you're a rotten husband. You neglect me absolutely. But I don't care. I'd rather have you than any decent husband. Besides, I'm going.
And she did. It was late at night when they arrived at Blackwater. A small covered launch came out from the shore to get them. It was plain to see that the captain was anxious to unload his passengers for St. Hubert and be gone from the place.
All right. You may climb down to the launch now. Hurry, please. I've got to get along.
You're the McGurk Commission?
Yes.
Good.
My name's Arrowsmith.
Well, I'm Dr. Stokes of St. Swithin's Parish.
This is my wife, Dr. Stokes.
Honored.
How do you do?
Tell me, how many cases of plague have you got now?
Lord knows. Maybe 1,000 and 10 million rats. I'll check on your luggage.
Oh, thank you very much. Leora.
Huh?
Quick now, you can still go back. You must,
and
please.
And leave this pretty launch? Oh, Sandy. Well, just look at the elegant engine it's got. Oh, gosh, Sandy, I'm scared blue.
The following afternoon, Inchcape Jones, Surgeon General of St. Hubert's, took Martin and Leora to Penrith Lodge on the cool hills behind Blackwater.
I think you'll find Penrith Lodge quite adequate, Doctor. Plenty of room here for your laboratory.
Oh, yes, it seems big enough.
And the place is absolutely rat-proof. Safest place on the island, I assure you.
Well, I'm sure you'll be quite
comfortable. I'll leave you now to get settled. But first, Dr. Arrowsmith.
Yes, sir?
There's one matter I must take up with you.
What is that?
I hear some talk that you want to give your phage to only half the people.
Yes, that's my plan.
Then I must tell you, as Surgeon General, I can't approve such action.
What?
Look here, man. You've got a life-saving serum. You can't withhold it from half the people and let the rest...
Dr. Jones, the work scientists do in the laboratories is useless unless it can be followed through with the same thoroughness. And I'm a scientist, not a sentimentalist.
And I, sir, am a human. Unless you agree to administer phage to everyone, I shall not permit you to administer it to anyone.
Days passed. The panic increased. But neither Dr. Jones nor Dr. Arrowsmith gave in. The citizens heard that Martin was withholding their salvation. It became a torment for him to go out in the street now.
That's the one. Arrowsmith. He calls himself a doctor.
He's a killer.
Doctor, I lose 4 children. Now my last one, my baby, dies. Save him. You can save
Have
him.
Have neither of you to put pity nor fear of your own death keep you from making the plague experiment.
Save us. Save
him. Can I trust you, Martin?
Just a little for
neither
my baby.
Neither pity nor fear.
A killer.
Can I trust you, Martin? Can I trust you?
Leora!
Sandy! Oh, Sandy!
Leora. Poor darling.
Three days later, Inchcape Jones was dead. Thus came Martin to his experiment. Dr. Stokes was appointed Surgeon General.
Now I can go to work, Lee. Stokes is in complete agreement with my plan.
Oh, I'm so glad. So thankful,
Sandy. I'm going to start my work in St. Swithin's Parish. The plague's worse there. Oh. But now, look, don't worry about me. I'll stay at the Twyfords. I'll be very safe.
Oh, but you...
Darling, now look. This time I can't take you.
Well, you can't...
No. Now, please. Stokes made the arrangements for me. The Twyfords are crowded now. I can't ask to bring you. Besides, I'll feel lots freer and safer to know that that you're here where it's absolutely safe.
Oh, but darling,
now, please, darling. As soon as I can find room for you, I'll come for you. In the meantime, now promise me you're going to take your shots every day.
Oh, all right. I know when I'm licked. Oh, but take care of yourself, darling. Hurry back to me. I don't even half exist when you're not around.
The first week in St. Swithin's stretched on like one long hour for Martin, but for Leora back at Penrith Lodge, the time was unending. One evening, she wandered into his laboratory because she felt closer to him there. She found one of his half-smoked cigarettes, picked it up, lighted it. But that morning, a maid had knocked over a test tube. The cigarette seemed dry enough, but in it, there were enough plague germs to kill a regiment. The maids found she was ill and they fled from the house. Her throat cracked with thirst. She crawled to the kitchen for water.
If I could just get water. Oh, Sandy. Sandy, that you said? No, not here. He told me to do something. I can't remember. Water. I can't stand up.
Oh, Sandy. The floor is moving and the walls are coming down. If I could just get up, I'd walk to you. Water. I'm so hot. Sandy, you will come. Come and help me. I know, Sandy, you'll come. Please. Sandy. Sandy!
From Hollywood, the NBC University Theater is bringing you Van Heflin in our adaptation of the Sinclair Lewis novel, Aerosmith, the seventh in the series of dramatizations of outstanding works by modern British and American authors. Information on how to obtain free materials on the authors and books presented in this series will be given at the close of the program. Now, here to comment on the Sinclair Lewis work is Mr. Granville Hicks, distinguished author of The Great Tradition, John Reed, The Making of a Revolutionary, and Small Town. Our intermission commentator, Mr. Hicks, speaking from New York.
Sinclair Lewis has been writing novels ever since 1914, and he has written a great many, some good, some pretty bad. Of the good ones, there are four that might be called the pillars on which his reputation rests: Main Street, Babbitt, Arrowsmith, and Dodsworth, all of them published in the 1920s. Arrowsmith has always been the popular favorite. Literary critics may argue that Babbitt is the book that really shows how our business civilization works, or they may say that Dodsworth is the best piece of writing, the most imaginative and the most mature of the novels. But the public, which frequently refuses to behave as the experts think it ought to, has always voted for Arrowsmith. And it is not hard to see why. Among its assets, Arrowsmith has not only the most attractive hero, and by all odds the most appealing heroine Lewis ever invented, but also a subject of perennial interest and many of the elements of a success story. At the same time, Arrowsmith is pure Sinclair Lewis. As he describes the pilgrimage of Martin Arrowsmith, Lewis pours forth his scorn on greedy and incompetent doctors wherever he finds them. And he finds them all the way from the small towns to the highest professional and social levels of New York City. Nor is he shooting only at the doctors. As his hero moves up the ladder, Lewis finds plenty to satirize on every rung. Lewis's satire doesn't always wear well. Some of it, in fact, seems embarrassingly obvious. There are whole pages that make you feel that Lewis isn't any great shakes of a writer. But just as you are reaching that conclusion, you come across a passage that takes your breath away because it is so exactly right, because it renders so wonderfully not merely the outward appearance, but also the inner meaning of some piece of American life. There are such insights even in the poorest of Lewis's novels, and the good ones are full of them. You cannot read these novels without coming to a better understanding of America and perhaps of yourself as well. It should also be said that Sinclair Lewis is not what he pretends to be. Although he is often posed as a cynic and an iconoclast, he has a great affection for people, all kinds of people, and a deep passion for truth and justice. Witness, for example, his most recent novel, King's Blood Royal, which is a strong plea for justice, and witness Arrowsmith, which is a plea for honesty. This is no cynic, but a man who has sought the truth and has found some part of it.
Thank you, Mr. Hicks. Now our adaptation of the Sinclair Lewis novel Arrowsmith, with Van Heflin in the leading role, continues from Hollywood after a brief pause for station identification.
also staying at the Twyford home in St. Swithin's, was the wealthy young widow, Joyce Lanyon. She had come to St. Hubert to see her plantations and had been trapped by the quarantine. Martin admired her willingness to help with the cleaning and cooking, and he found her company pleasant after the long days of work.
I still say it's inhuman, keeping the phage from half these poor people.
Well, you aren't the first to say that, you know. I've heard that on all sides. But I'm getting results. Nothing can make me do it now, not even if they tried to lynch me.
Well, I won't try to argue with you. It's too pleasant a night.
Yes, isn't it?
Tell me about your wife.
It's kind of hard to explain or describe your wife, I guess. I hope you like each other, but I don't know if you will or not. You're so darn different.
Oh?
Well, yeah, you're awfully articulate. You've been all over the world. Lee's never been any place but where I've dragged her. And
oh.
You have beautiful clothes, and you wear them very well. And
oh.
I know Leora doesn't know what she has on half the time. She just sits back and, well, I don't mean, you know, she never misses anything, but she never says much.
Mm-hmm.
Still, she's got the best instinct for honesty I think I've ever known.
You make me feel like a terrible phony.
Oh, no, wait a minute. I didn't mean that, not at all. I think you're tops, but honestly, I hope you'll get on together.
Was she coming here?
Yes, I was afraid to let her come at first. I didn't know what I'd find, but now I know it's safe. I'm going to go back for her later tonight. As soon as Mr. Twyford comes back with his car, I'm going to bustle right over to Penrith. Leora! Lee, I'm here! Hey, Leora, I'm back! Where is that woman? Hey, Lee! She's probably sound asleep. Leora, come on, wake up! Funny, I wonder where those servants are. Leora! This place is filthy. The servants must have... Leora! Ah, there you are. Leora? Are you asleep? You're asleep, aren't you, Lee? Leora, come on, answer me. Leora? Leora? Come in.
Hello, Martin.
What do you want?
I want to talk to you.
Well, I don't want to talk to you. I'm drunk. I'm drunk all the time.
I know. That's why I came.
All my fault. Well, I was safe in St. Swithin's shoes.
It wasn't your fault. It wasn't anyone's. But to give up now, that would be unforgivable. Won't you let me offer you friendship?
Oh, I don't want anybody's friendship. I haven't got any friends.
But when Joyce left, Martin felt a shiver of new courage. Most evenings from then on, he was sober. But because the need for it had for the first time been brought to him, he gave the phage to everyone who asked. When Martin returned to the Institute, he found that Dr. Gottlieb had resigned because of ill health, and the new director, Dr. Rippleton Holabird, was using Martin as his prize exhibit.
Dr. Holabird, I feel that it's a very grave mistake to give out all this talk to the newspapers until my results have been given statistical analysis.
Oh, come now. You know you've done what very few other living men could do, and you must take the credit, do you, and the Institute you represent.
But until we have the proof, sir,
I have proof enough for me. Now, you must leave such matters for me to decide. Oh, incidentally, my boy, I'm making you head of your department.
Martin took his anger to his one remaining friend at the Institute, the uncouth, blustering bachelor chemist, Terry Wickett.
I'll resign, Terry. I swear I will. Publishing all this stuff without any real proof. I'll expose that guy.
Hey, Slim, hold on. Wait a minute.
Why should I?
Listen to me. Just get along with Holy Bird for a while. We'll work out something we can do together. Be independent.
What do you mean, we can work out something?
I'll tell you, Slim. See, I got a shack up in the Vermont Hills, 2 miles from a railroad station. Someday I'll figure out a way of making the lab pay up there. The manufacturing sear or something. We can work, say, 2 hours a day on the commercial end. The rest of the time we'll be absolutely free for scientific research.
Free?
No director, no society patrons, no trustees. How's that sound?
Well, that sounds just too good to be true.
Yeah, we'll have it, son. Just wait. Now, stick it out here a while longer. 1 more year. 2 at most.
But within a year, Martin was married to Joyce Lanyon. In the first year of his marriage, Martin was happy. He was exploring a new life with Joyce, and he and Terry were working together on pneumococcus. They began to have a few good results, but unfortunately, Dr. Holabird heard about them.
I understand you men have a cure for pneumonia. Well, that's...
Oh, now, wait just a minute, sir. We have a few findings, but nothing to support a claim.
Well, then let me have those, and we'll publish them.
We will not. And by the time you change the wordings of our report, you'd have the whole world coming to the doors of McGurk, looking for a cure for pneumonia.
It's time to let the world know what you're doing, Wickett.
Well, if I did, the world would know a doggone sight more than I do. Nothing doing, Chief. Maybe we can publish in a year from now.
You will publish now or else...
All right, Holy Bird. The blessed moment has arrived. I quit. And I'm so gentlemanly that I'll do it without telling you what I think of you.
Thus was Terry Wickett discharged from McGurk. Martin assumed that he too would resign. He explained it to Joyce on their way home from a dinner party.
Now, can you beat that? The Holy Wren fires Terry, but he doesn't dare touch me.
Oh, what will Dr. Wickett do now?
Oh, well, he's all set. He's patented his process of synthesizing quinine. He'll retire to his place up in Vermont and start real scientific research. I waited simply because I wanted to watch Holabird figure out what I'd do. Now...
And now?
Well, now I'm free. By thunder, I'm free at last. Because I've worked up to something that's worth being free for. Well,
I still don't quite know what you plan to do, dear.
Well, work with Terry, naturally. We've only begun
our... Wait just a moment, please.
Well, look, I'll accomplish
Marge,
so much...
If you went on working with Dr. Wickett, you'd have to be leaving me constantly.
Well, not... on and off,
I
yes,
really
that...
don't think that would be quite nice. I mean, especially now, because I fancy I'm going to have a baby.
Joyce.
Oh, I'm not going to do the weeping, Mother, but it does complicate things, you know.
Yes.
And personally, I should be sorry if you left the Institute, which gives you a solid position for some hole-and-corner existence. I don't want you to desert me. And you would if you went off to this horrid Vermont place.
Well, couldn't we get a little house near there and spend part of the year or
possibly,
something?
Possibly, but... Oh, let's wait till this beastly job of bearing a dear little one is over. Then we can think about it.
Martin did not resign from the Institute, and Joyce didn't think about taking a house in Vermont to the extent of doing it. After their son was born, Joyce begrudged even more the evenings Martin spent in his laboratory.
But, Joyce, you must understand I've got to work nights. Holabird keeps me so busy with unimportant things during the day and... Well, I won't let Terry Wickett get ahead of me up there in Vermont.
I know, but, darling, you get so nervous when you're working like this. And when you make yourself so drawn and trembly, are you gaining time in the long run? It's just for your own
sake.
I'm
sorry, Joyce, but I'll never be able to keep regular hours and...
Oh, wait. I have it.
What?
You'll see. Never mind. You'll see what a scientist
but,
I am.
What
no,
you...
I won't explain I... now. Not yet. But just you wait.
Two weeks later, after dinner one evening, a gallant, joyous Joyce led Martin to the two unoccupied rooms over the garage behind their house.
Now, what is all this mystery, Joyce?
Just a moment now. There you are, Dr. Arrowsmith.
Well,
Isn't it wonderful, darling? Don't you know what it is?
Well, I would say it remarkably resembles a laboratory.
Oh, but of course. But not just anybody's, dear. It's your lab. Your very own. And I'll wager it's the best bacteriology lab in the country. Look at your ice box, your incubator. Here's your microscope. And this is a perfect, what they called it, constant temperature bath.
Yeah. Well, it certainly has everything.
Oh, darling, you do like it, don't you?
Oh, well, yes. Yes, dear, of course.
Now, when you simply must work evenings, you can slip out here and work as late as you want. You are pleased, aren't you?
Sure. Sure, you better.
Why, you'll finish your experiment months before Terry Wickett up in that barbaric hideaway.
Through the circle of Joyce's friends, the rumor panted that there was a new diversion in an exhausted world.
Excuse me, just a minute.
Isn't he adorable, the way he teaches his darling bacteria to say pretty Polly?
Mart is so cute with all those little vases.
Just precisely what is he doing?
Oh, he's, all sorts of interesting things.
Oh, please, Mart, do something exciting for us. Pretty, please. Can't you create life out of turtle eggs or whatever it is?
Why, Martin, did you drop something?
I'm sorry, am I... My hand slipped.
Not losing the old grip, are you, son?
I do hope there wasn't anything serious in those little vases.
No, just flu germs, I think. Though, of course, that may have been one of the leprosy vases.
Oh, my dear!
The following winter, Dr. and Mrs. Rickleton Holabird invited Joyce and Martin to dinner. They were the only guests. Holabird was his most charming self. He admired Joyce's pearls, and when the squabs had been served, he turned on Martin with friendly intensity.
Big things are happening, Martin, and I want you... No, science wants you to take your proper place in them.
What, some new experiment?
Or... Oh, no, much bigger. Martin, as you know, Dr. Tubbs left the Institute to head the new League of Cultural Agencies. And Colonel Minigan, who is backing the League, has been extraordinarily generous.
Well, the old bird... he's quite wealthy.
Yes, I have certain reasons for supposing I can bring Ross McGurk and Minigan together. So, I shall probably quit the Institute and help Tubbs guide the League of Cultural Agencies. And then we'll need a new director of McGurk who will work with us.
Won't that be simply exciting?
Yes.
Now, Martin, I have faith in you. I believe now that you've seen more of Joyce's set and mine. Well, I believe I can coax you to take a broader view.
A broader view?
Yes. I'm authorized to appoint an assistant director. And I think I'm safe in saying that he would succeed me as full director. I dare say in a year or two, you will be director of McGurk.
Martin.
Really? I feel honored to be present at such an occasion.
Why, I'll have to think this over. It's sort of unexpected, if you know.
Well, certainly. Take time, day or even two. Talk it over with Joyce. Oh, I do have faith in you, Martin, dear old boy.
Isn't it too wonderful, Mart? And I do feel Rippleton Holabird can bring it off. Oh, think of your being director, head of that whole institute.
Would you really like to see me director?
Well, of course. All that... I don't just mean the prominence and respect, but the power to accomplish good.
Would you like to see me dictating letters and giving out interviews, buying linoleum and having lunch with distinguished fools? Trying to advise men about whose work I don't know a blame thing.
Oh, don't be superior. Someone has to do these things.
And you really would have me give up my own work.
You know, Mart, I'm the last person to speak of money, but really it's you who so often brought up the matter of hating to be dependent on me. And, you know, as director, you'd make so much more that... Oh, Martin, forgive me.
Martin didn't go through the turmoil of deciding. He leaped to a decision without it. Later that night, he marched into Joyce's room.
Well?
Well, I'm not going to do it, even if I have to leave the Institute, and Holabird will just about make me quit. I will not get buried in this pompous fakery of giving orders. What I ought to do is to go up to Vermont right now and work with Terry.
The old argument, the wiles, the simple life. It's just the absurd, cowardly sort of thing these tired highbrows do, that sneak off to some esoteric colony and think they're getting strength to conquer life when they're merely running away from
it. Oh, no, no, you're wrong, Joyce. Terry has his place in the country only because he can live cheaper up there.
Look here, Mart. You feel so virtuous about wanting to go off and wear a flannel shirt and be peculiar and very, very pure. Suppose everybody argued that way. Just what would become of the world? Suppose I were poor and you left me and I had to support John by taking in washing.
Well, it'd probably be fine for you, but first on the washing. Oh, no, I beg your pardon. That was an obvious answer.
Martin, listen to me.
No, no, now this debate could go on forever. The fact is that I've suddenly seen that I must go. I want my freedom to work, and I herewith quit. You've been very generous to me, and I'm grateful. You've been kind. But you've never been mine. Goodbye, Joyce.
Martin drove up to Terry's shanty in a bobsled. Terry was chopping wood in a mess of chip-littered snow.
Hi, Terry.
Hello, Slim.
Well, I've come for keeps, Terry.
Fine, Slim. Say, there's a lot of dishes up in the shack need washing.
Martin had become soft. To dress in the cold shanty and to wash in icy water was agony. But the rapture of being allowed to work 24 hours a day carried him on. And after a few months, he felt himself growing sinewy. He was quite at home that day, the following spring, when he peeped out to see a gigantic motor car crawl up their woods road and come to a stop.
It's a sweet place, really, Mart.
Yeah. You look beautiful, Joyce.
Oh, darling, I have missed you. I've come to stay.
What?
I'll build a house near here. A wide, low house with enormous verandas and red awnings.
And visitors coming.
I suppose so, sometimes. Why?
Joyce, I do love you. I want awfully just now to kiss you properly. But I will not have you bringing me a lot of people up here. There'd probably be a rotten, noisy motor launch. Make a joke out of our lab, a roadhouse, a new sensation. Why, Terry, he'd go crazy. You are lovely, but you want a playmate, and I want to work. No, I'm afraid you can't stay.
Martin, aren't you perhaps a little insane?
Oh, absolutely, and how I enjoy it. No, now, wait a minute. Let me think. I don't believe we're insane. We're farmers.
Martin, you've left common sense completely. Well, I am common sense. I believe in bathing. Goodbye.
On a certain May evening, Dr. Rippleton Holabird was addressing a meeting of celebrated thinkers assembled by the League of Cultural Activities. That evening, Max Gottlieb sat unmoving and alone in a dark, small room above the banging city street. Only his eyes were alive now. That evening, hot breezes languished along a palm-waving ridge, and a depression in a garden marked the grave of Leora. That evening, after an unusually gay dinner, Joyce admitted to a gentleman friend,
"Yes, if I do divorce him, I may marry you." "I know. He's never going to see how egotistical it is to think he's the only man living who's always right."
And that evening, Martin Arrowsmith and Terry Wickett lolled in a clumsy boat, an extraordinarily uncomfortable boat, far out on the water. And Martin said,
"Well, Terry, this new quinine stuff may prove pretty good. We'll plug along on it for 2 or 3 years, and maybe we'll get something permanent." "Probably we'll fail."
The curtain falls on the 7th in our series of dramatizations of outstanding works by modern British and American authors. Today, the NBC University Theater has brought you the Sinclair Lewis novel, Arrowsmith, as adapted for radio by Agnes Eckhart. Our intermission commentator was the distinguished author, Mr. Granville Hicks. Van Heflin was starred in the role of Martin Arrowsmith. Van Heflin is currently starred with Lana Turner, Gene Kelly, and June Allison in the Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Technicolor production, The Three Musketeers. Today's cast included Ted Von Eltz, Jerome Sheldon, Jan Arvin, Lois Corbett, Lynn Allen, Stephen Chase, Joe Forte, Sarah Jane Wells, John Daner, Clark Cuney, Edith Tackner. Next week at this time, the NBC University Theater turns to the work of a British author, the author Somerset Maugham, the novel Of Human Bondage, and the stars, Brian Ahern, internationally celebrated star of stage and screen, and Angela Lansbury, currently starred in the Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Technicolor production, The Three Musketeers. Productions of the NBC University Theater are currently being used in conjunction with college home study courses in Anglo-American fiction under NBC's National College by Radio plan. This plan permits NBC listeners to obtain college-supervised, organized education at home by means of radio listening and supplementary study. For full information about the authors and how to take advantage of this home study plan, which is currently being developed at the University of Louisville and elsewhere, send a penny postcard to College by Radio Courses, National Broadcasting Company, New York 20, New York. That's College by Radio Courses, National Broadcasting Company, New York 20, New York. Your director was Andrew C. Love. Original music for Arrowsmith was composed and conducted by Henry Russell. This program came to you from Hollywood. 2.5 hours of great comedy is yours tonight. Just listen. Ozzie and Harriet, Jack Benny, Phil Harris and Alice Faye, Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, and Fred Allen with his guest Arthur Treacher. 5 of radio's finest shows in rapid and very funny succession. Remember, for the best time of your life, the best time is tonight on most of these NBC stations. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.